Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arseblog Arsecast right here on arseblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. I am furious. Absolutely apoplectic with rage. I'll tell you why. I've got a Garmin. I've got one of those watches. It's a Garmin thing. It tracks you when you do your exercise, when you're walking, your steps, when you're running, when you're sight. It does all that shit. Gets your heartbeat. What's my heartbeat at this moment in time? It's 70. Should be going up now as I get more and more. Oh, fuck, 74. Anyway, every so often, the watch buzzes and tells you, move, move. And every single time, it makes me angry. I was just moving before I sat down to do this podcast. Why can't you, if you're so fucking brilliant at technology, Garmin, realize that I've stopped moving and I deserve the right to sit down without you badgering me to get up and move again? I'll move when I like. Goddamn watch. Anyway, apart from that, I'm fine. I hope you're fine. Hope you're doing well this week. The football is back. Arsenal return this weekend. We go to Vicarage Road to play Elton John's Watford, of course. Saturday evening kickoff, so we got to wait all day Saturday, and then it's Saturday evening. And that kind of messes with your schedule a bit, doesn't it? Are you going to go out on Saturday night after the game? Is it a bit late to leave the house by the time the match ends and I do all the bits and pieces that I've got to do for the website? Is it too late? Am I too old now to consider going out at 9 o'clock or 9:30? I probably am. I feel more comfortable coming home at that time than going out these days. That says a lot about me. Anyway, I don't want to complain. I don't want to rant. I don't want to turn this into a litany of complaints that I could go on and on about. I don't want to do that because we're here for different things, for entertainment purposes and for hilarity and jollity and japes and a bit of Arsenal thrown in. So in a few minutes' time, I'm going to be talking to Amy Lawrence. She is involved in a film called 89, which is about the fateful night we won the league at Anfield in 1989. I know the 63,412 Arsenal fans who were in the ground that night will remember it well, as will all of us who watched it on TV, wherever we might have been. It was one of those unforgettable nights. So we're going to talk to Amy about the movie. We're going to talk to her about the night itself and a bit of general Arsenal chat as well. So that's coming up for you in just a few minutes' time. Just to recap on what's happened in the international break, Shkodran Mustafi has got injured. He'll be out for 4 to 6 weeks. So that's a bit of a blow for our central defenders. Callum Chambers has signed a new deal, which has come a little bit out of the blue. Nobody really expected that, not least because there doesn't appear to be anybody at the club anymore who can deal with contracts. Oh, apart from that new contract guy we got in the summer. So we've put him to work. Well done to that man. Got Callum Chambers all signed up. Mark Overmars was linked with a return to the club. Mark Overmars, who scored some goals for us down the years in our first title-winning season, 97-98 under Arsene Wenger, first title-winning season under Arsene Wenger. Just wanted to be really clear that that's what I meant. I wasn't saying that was our first title or anything like that. You know the way things get taken out of context these days. You've got to be clear. Anyway, there was rumours that he was going to come in. He's reached agreement with Arsenal to come in next summer as who knows what. Not director of football. He won't be director of football. We know that. He'll be like football executive or football dude or something like that. He'll get an office maybe. But that was all played down by Arsene Wenger, by the club, who said no. Nothing like that is happening for now. Tapping their noses, etc., etc. Whether it's Overmars or whether it's somebody else, it's got to be somebody. Arsenal really needs somebody to fill the gap because Dick Law is gone. We have no Dick. We are Dickless. Since the end of September, he has gone back to America. And, you know, there's a January transfer window coming up in which Arsene Wenger said he might consider the sale of Alexis Sanchez and Mesut Ozil. He said you can't rule out the possibility in this situation. It's possible. Who's going to do it? Ivan? Arsene? They could, but you need the guy. You need the guy in there to do the handshake and the back slap and the come round. Come on, you know the guy. You know that guy. Come on, give us some money for him. Come on, that fella. We need that fella in January. We don't need him next summer. We need him soon because there's work to do in January. So hopefully we get that sorted. What's my goddamn phone making noises? If it's not my Garmin, it's my phone. And apart from that, in the international break, some of the players are happy. Some of the players won't be so happy. Alexis Sanchez won't be going to the World Cup. So hurrah, he gets a summer off. Unfortunately, it's the summer in which he'll probably leave the club. So whatever team he joins next July or June, or whatever team he agrees to join in January, he can talk to other clubs from January onwards, other clubs across Europe, not other Premier League clubs. The rule works a little differently. They will get a fully rested Alexis Sanchez. He won't be slugging his heart out in Russia, rushing around the pitch like a madman, training like a madman. He'll probably be doing those things anyway, just not on television in front of everybody at the World Cup. And Aaron Ramsey and Wales, they won't be going to the World Cup. Will he be disappointed? I'm sure he will. Failure to beat Ireland means that Wales do not qualify once more for the World Cup. And I'd say for Ramsey, who obviously has ambitions to play at a World Cup, that's probably like seeing 407 rhinos shot in front of him. You know, he's a big rhino guy. Don't shoot rhinos, please. They're, you know, they are terrifying. I think rhinos with the, you know, they're like armored cows. You just don't know when they could turn on you. And they've got like this protective plating and a horn, you know, but really, unless one is coming straight for you and you happen to have a gun and you need to shoot the rhino to protect yourself, to continue living, and if you don't feel like sacrificing your life for that of a rhino, then don't shoot them. That's my advice. That's the piece of wisdom that you can take from this podcast. But we'll have to see. Will Alexis be unhappy? Will Ramsey be unhappy? Will they be focused? Remember Andrei Arshavin when Russia didn't qualify for the World Cup? He was so, so sad for so many years. He went on a kind of a biscuit spiral. It wasn't biscuits. It was Battenberg. He was never the same again. God, everything's making clunky noises. So look, we might just touch very briefly on the team news for Saturday's game after I chat with Amy. But for now, come on, let's do it. Let's start talking about 1989. This is me and Amy Lawrence. Let's go back a little bit before we focus on that season, because I think it's worth just stepping back a few years. Arsenal hadn't won the league for 18 years. It was 1971 was the last time Arsenal had won the league. The last trophy was 1979 in the FA Cup. There were losing finals in the FA Cup in 1980, the Cup Winners' Cup as well. But the 80s were a fairly barren period for Arsenal. And that started to change around 1986 when a former player and then a former boss of Millwall, George Graham, was appointed.
Yeah, and what's great about that is hindsight being the wonderful thing that it is. If you went back to that summer when George Graham was appointed, it would be overstretching the mark to say that everybody was really excited. Mm. Here was a guy who, for a start, when he, you know, he'd been a legendary player and part of the 1971 double winning side, but he was known as the stroller. He was a guy who looked good and took his, I mean, in many ways, you know, the sort of one would hesitate to make stupid comparisons, but that slightly languid thing that people don't like about Ozil with his body language and that he always looks quite vain and, you know, that makes sure he looks good. And those were sort of some of the characteristics, I suppose, that were associated with George Graham as a player. He was a guy who was never in a rush. He everybody knew he liked the good life outside of football. And he was not ever, even amongst his teammates, somebody that they had nailed down to be a manager. In fact, he was probably the last one on the list because He didn't really give that much impression as a player that he would go home and study football and think about football and be tactical and all those things that, in fact, he turned into. He subsequently, when he finished playing, went off and got stuck into coaching and made a success of things in what was then the old second division, a second tier of English football with Millwall. But, you know, to appoint a Scottish manager who was a quite laid-back kind of a player who was in the second division, this was not the sort of thing that people thought was going to rock Arsenal to its foundations. And yet that's exactly what he did.
Yeah.
He came in, his attitude was he didn't really fancy stars, you know what I mean, unless they were performing stars. He wasn't interested in fancy Dans that swanned around picking up what was then a quite nice wage packet and kind of enjoying playing for a London club. And
yeah,
he wanted serious attitude and hunger and determination and desire. I think desire was probably his favourite word. And he set about building a team in that mould, which meant being quite brave and turfing out experienced internationals who held quite a lot of sway in the dressing room, bringing in young, hungry players. They had a fantastic generation. Tony Adams, Paul Merson, Michael Thomas, David Rowcastle, and more. It was a sensational group of players who had come through roughly at the same time. And then he had a brilliant eye for a young, hungry player who was perhaps playing in a lower division or a smaller club, and he thought, right, you'll do for me, and went scouring the country and picking up Dixon, Winterburn, Bold, Alan Smith, Brian Marwood, Kevin Richardson. Guys who in the main had not been successful yet, but he believed that they had a lot more to offer than they'd been able to show in terms of achievements in their career.
Mm.
And quite quickly, it all began to click. And, you know, there was a sense that a really promising team was developing. Having said that, you can't talk about that era without having the context of Liverpool.
Yeah.
Who were so dominant, it's quite difficult for probably youngsters today to have any kind of inkling as to how impressive, how awe-inspiring they were. I mean, the majority of people who weren't Liverpool fans hated them because they were so successful, and they were basically jealous of Liverpool because
the Manchester,
they won all the time.
Yeah.
They won the league virtually all the time. They won cups, loads and loads and loads. And you didn't, as a football fan of almost any other team, you didn't really think that you had much chance against Liverpool when it came down to it. So the start of the 88-89 season.
Well, can I stop you there before we go on to that? Because
about 3 hours, and I'm not really, you know, getting anywhere near to what we've been doing yet. But please go on.
No, well, I want to ask you, because having not won a trophy for so many years, the first season that George was in charge, you won the League Cup at Wembley against Liverpool. There was that magical moment when Charlie Nicholas bundled in the goal, and he went off dancing with Perry Groves. When you look back at that, we've often talked about how a team that hasn't had success for a while needs to believe that they can achieve something, needs to believe that they can win things before they can really go on and do it. I mean, it hasn't quite worked in recent years with Arsenal. We thought maybe after so many years without a trophy, winning the FA Cups might be the thing to springboard the team to title success. But looking back on it, I think that was a really important win for Arsenal, even if the final the following year didn't go as well as everyone would have liked. But it sort of perhaps instilled in those some of those younger players as well, there is a belief that you can go and you can beat a team like Liverpool, who were just so dominant at that time. They were untouchable almost.
Yeah, I think so. And I kind of that 1987 League Cup win that you talk about, Littlewood's Cup as it was then, against Liverpool, in a way, when Arsenal did beat Hull and in the cup final in 2014 and finally put an end to a little bit of a barren spell. And like you say, I think it did fuel the players with a sense of belief that they can do something for themselves. But I still think that, look, going into that season, Arsenal were 16-1 to win the league and Liverpool were evens.
Mm.
That's a pretty substantial gap to be made up by an inexperienced team who's never won a title before. You know, we're not talking about something like Leicester of a couple of seasons ago, but there was still there was a pretty big leap of faith to imagine that a team like Arsenal in that era would be winning the league at the expense of a team like Liverpool in that era.
Yeah.
What felt like a really considerable gap. Although as the season went on and they played each other a few times in different competitions, it was clear that there was a closeness that was, and that the Arsenal team felt that they were able to compete, you know, eyeball to eyeball with Liverpool. There was a brilliant League Cup game at Anfield where Dave Rocastle scored an absolute scorcher. Wow, you know, it felt like a big stepping stone to be able to go to Anfield, the lair of the, you know, as close as damn it to invincible, sort of imperious team of the age, and really at times outplay them and probably be unlucky to have only ended up with a draw.
Yeah.
And they thought they were something there. But I think what was interesting about the making of this film is that you want to get the context and the backstory and all this kind of stuff. But what happened more and more as we were looking into things and going back over things and talking to people is that you evoke that what was going on at the time, and it's very nostalgic, culturally, socially, what it was like to be a football fan then, what the game was like then. But also, there were so many interesting little things that happened during the course of that season. But what you don't want to do with a film like this is make it a sort of fancy end of season roundup.
Yeah.
You know, there's a real proper drama going on in this, in what happened that season, with some hugely significant strands to it. Not the least that the Hillsborough disaster happens towards the end of that season, and you can't, you know, Arsenal. But people associated with Arsenal have extremely massively strong feelings about what happened at Anfield 89. If you speak to most fans of a certain age, it's the one.
Mm.
It's the one above all else. But you cannot really have that genuine conversation. It was, the two things are bound together. You had one of the worst events and one of the most profoundly upsetting thing to ever happen if you love football.
Yeah.
In April in 1989. And 6 weeks later, this thing happened that, for Arsenal supporters, is probably the highlight of their, you know, the best thing ever, the highest of the high. It was pretty extreme to go from one to the other in what was quite a short space of time, really.
Yeah.
So those two events have a relationship within themselves, apart from the quite literal fact that one doesn't happen without the other, because Liverpool and Arsenal, which ended up being the, you know, essentially the playoff for the league title, that, you know, the very final game, everybody else had finished playing and the whole of football stopped to watch this showdown, first against second, winner takes all, essentially. But it was really, that game was originally set to be played the week after the Hillsborough disaster. So the fact that football actually stopped for 2 weeks, which it did at the time, and nobody knew what was going on, whether it would start again, what was going to happen. Nobody even wanted to think about it because it was almost too overwhelming to think, are you supposed to care about football anymore? Does it matter?
Yeah.
Should we be doing this? It was complex, deeply, deeply complex and emotionally loaded moment in time. So you've gone from this terribly difficult, almost unimaginably unbearable thing to a situation where sport becomes, it's hard to say, but it meant so much what happened that night, obviously not to the people of Liverpool, when the game was played on the 26th of May and it was the big finale, but it was a very, very significant point for football. And I sometimes think that what went on with the game and the way that the game changed, you realise how pivotal those few weeks were, because the game became, you know, reborn and reformed in some way with the response to what happened at Hillsborough, with grounds becoming all seater, with trying to attract different kind of types of bands, with trying to monetize it. It was quite soon you got Sky Sports, the Premier League, the rebranding, the internationalization, people coming in and starring from all over the world. It was a very British game back in 1989. You look at the team sheets of that game, and it was pretty much exclusively British and Irish players involved. Bruce Grobbelaar was the goalie for Liverpool, and that was, I think probably the only exception, unless my memory is playing tricks on me. But
can I ask how the Anfield thing played on the minds of the Arsenal players? Because obviously it was a huge event for Liverpool, and we know the stories of Liverpool players attending the funerals and the impact that it had on that particular community. But as footballers and as people who would have witnessed similar events inside football grounds, which thankfully never had the consequences that we saw at Hillsborough, it can't have been something that the Arsenal players were blind to or immune from as well.
Not at all. And I think actually for some of the players who we spoke to all these years down the line, you know, the impact of how confused I think they felt at that time maybe came out all these years later, and trying to articulate what they thought and how they felt or how they dealt with it or tried to deal with it or weren't sure what to do. I mean, in many ways, I think football became a way of them being able to try and process it, because they were told what to do. They were told that football was stopping, and they were told when football was starting again. And then you go in and you train and you start to play and you start to try and win matches and do the things that is your normal life. And in some ways I think that was a mechanism for not having, you know, for not avoiding, but trying, you know, not having to really deal with the reality of what had happened. But you know, the other thing that became interesting in the trying construction of this film, obviously it takes a big emotional turn at that point, but the game itself, as the more that we spoke to people about it along the way, and the more that they were going through the details of their recollections of that famous day of the game at Anfield, the more we realised that actually the game gets stretched. So instead of it taking up a kind of small proportion of the film, it's the bulk of it revolves around the actual day, because people's memories of it are so special, so detailed, so crystal clear, and so emotive still. And what's quite interesting is that you get the feeling almost like you're watching a live game, because it's broken down so much and it's, you know, so deconstructed that instead of feeling like you're watching something that happened in the past, when you're watching it, you feel like you're watching it again live for real now. It's quite interesting. Yeah. It's kind of in the past and in the present at the same time. And you get bound up in it all over again. So it's been really exciting to have a go at trying to translate the feelings around that game.
I mean, there was in the build up to the game a sort of sense of missed opportunity from an Arsenal point of view, because there was a, to put the game in context, there was a home defeat to Derby, and Liverpool then beat, I think it was West Ham, wasn't it? They beat them 5-1, which gave them a lead on goal difference, which meant that, I mean, this is how tight it was. Arsenal, if they won the game, would be level on points with Liverpool, but they had to win by two clear goals, because they would have had more than two clear goals or more, because anything else would have seen Liverpool win the league on goal difference. Arsenal, as it turned out, obviously won the game. We're not making any spoilers here, but they won it on goals scored, not just goal difference. The goal difference was the same, but Arsenal won the league by virtue of having scored more goals. It could not be any tighter.
Yeah, and the last chance comes in stoppage time of the entire season. I mean, it's if you went to Hollywood with it, you don't know whether they'd laugh you out of town or whether they'd say, actually, this is exactly what we want, because it's so unbelievable and extraordinary. It was just something that you can imagine if you, you know, it just seemed stranger than real life that it actually happened, or that it was going to boil down to that moment. And the, you know, the tension of that falling, that chance falling to Michael Thomas as it did. And that was one of the great treasures of the experience of making this film, was actually being able to ask him to relive what he was thinking and feeling in that moment, and what his teammates thought of the fact that it was him. Well, I'd say virtually all of his teammates seemed to give the impression that they really felt, if there was one man on earth that you want to be in that situation with everything on his shoulders and in, you know, resting on his boot in the last seconds of a season, you'd choose Michael Thomas.
In the trailer, I think it's Nigel Winterburn who goes, "I'm just standing there going, shoot, will you do it? And like, it's, I know I've watched it, I don't know how many times in my life, and I'm sure everybody listening has seen it countless times in their lives. But every single time, there's just a part of me that thinks that one touch, he's taken one touch too many, he's going to get blocked. But obviously didn't. But I mean, there is that, even when you watch it now, it's hard to escape the feeling that you had while watching it live, because it was such a remarkable thing, because of what it meant and the impact that it had for us as Arsenal fans to see the club win the league after so many years, but then win it in that fashion. It's inescapable. It's like some people, if they get the smell of something, it transports them back to a place. I don't know how to describe it, but every time I see that, I think he's going to just hold on to it too long.
We came across a photograph that I'd not seen before as well, in kind of going through all the stuff in the making of the film. And it was an angle that it honestly looks like Ray Houghton's got his foot on the ball as Michael Thomas is about to hit. It's extraordinary. You look at it and you think, how is it possible that actually Houghton doesn't clear the ball and divert it? Because it looks like he's got it. It's that close. It's wafer thin. Mm. You know, the margin between, you know, the story ending in a different way was staggeringly close.
People will ask, because it's a story that everybody knows so well, what's new? I mean, what did you discover? Were there things that you discovered while making this that weren't necessarily in the public domain? People's stories perhaps hadn't been told?
I guess you'd expect me to say yes. I mean, there was a lot of detail that was really eye-opening, even to a nerd like me. So, and just hearing the way that the people involved recalled with this fantastic clarity exactly the things that they were thinking and feeling at specific moments, and the breakdown of certain things that they were told, or that people said to them, or that they said to other people, and the little bits of colour and the little anecdotes just really bring it to life. And like I say, it gives you that sense of being in it. You feel a bit like you're in the story. And the other thing that was great is that we were able to access a camera that they had running all night from a vantage point, basically pitch side by the dugouts. And it was not used very often during the broadcast of the game, because they were using much wider images on the whole. But you get this kind of, you get this view, and it ran for 90, you know, I think virtually 90 minutes. You get this view, it's as if you're on the pitch, like between people's legs and with the ball moving around, and it's really close to the action. So that's another thing that is quite atmospheric, because it just gives you a different feeling to, even if you've watched the video 1,000 times of the game, it's not how you're used to seeing it. There's different angles and different details that come about.
Mm. Yeah, I have to say, I can't wait to see this, just because it looks from the trailer like nothing we've seen before in terms of 1988. And it's difficult, isn't it, I suppose, to try and tell a story that everybody knows so well and to try and find a new way to tell it. Was that a very conscious decision, or was that something that you felt you had to do before you started making this, that it had to go beyond the usual sort of narrative?
Well, I mean, you obviously fantasize about making the best thing you can possibly make, and making it as original and compelling as it can possibly be. And there are all sorts of you know, difficulties along the way. You know, what's amazing is how little footage there is of fans. You know, even photographs. At one point, I went out to Twitter and said, you know, anyone of the millions of people who went up to Anfield that night, take a camera with them, because even finding pictures of fans, you know, around the ground, inside the ground, on the coaches, on the motorways, whatever, it's quite scarce, because you forget. But you know, nowadays, everybody has access to some kind of camera, usually in their pocket on their phone. And in those days, if you took a camera into a ground, it would probably be confiscated. Yeah. So lots of people did take a camera to an event as massive as that. I mean, we just had this whole conversation about selfie gooners inside the stadium and this and that. But you know, this was miles before. I mean, you know, there was a guy who was talking about one of his best. It was one of the photographers who went up there to work that night who has some great tales of his own perspective. And he said his favourite image isn't something he took a photograph of that night. He was driving back down the motorway and they stopped up at a service station. And he saw this Arsenal fan by a public payphone. Because if you wanted to speak to someone in 1989 and go, "Hey, we're champions, we won the league," you had to go to payphone. You couldn't communicate with them any other way. And you had to hope that they were sitting by a phone attached to a wall to answer it.
Yeah.
So, and this guy, apparently his Arsenal shirt was ripped to bits. His face, his nose was splattered across his face. He looked an absolute mess. And he was crying, like screaming down the phone, singing champions, champions, like jigging around and dancing. And like this 3 a.m. image of like one random guy on the end of a phone is what sort of stuck in his mind. And there's, you know, everybody has their own little things that they remember, that they saw, that they felt. And it is one of those things, and this was one of the reasons why I think it was an idea where we were fortunate enough that Universal Pictures backed it. And I think one of the things that attracted them to it, apart from the story, it being a great moment and a great story with a lot of depth to it, is it's a bit of a "where were you" moment. Where, you know, I remember where I was when moment.
Sure.
And even people who don't really care about Arsenal, I know plenty of people who tell me that they remember exactly where they were. One of them, I was talking to a friend the other day, and he said, "I remember it vividly." He's not an Arsenal fan. He said, "We grew up, we didn't have a telly, and I remember it really well because we went round my grandma's house to watch it on telly." And I thought, wow, that's fantastic. And there's just zillions of little things that come to people's mind about it's like it transforms people back in time if you're as old as we are.
Yeah, maybe. Well, or older.
I don't know what we're talking about.
It's released on November 20th.
Yes. So hopefully anybody who feels tempted, I think it's available anyway now for like pre-order and stuff and all the usual outlets where you can get these kind of things. And there's still discussions ongoing about where else it might appear, and we'll have to watch that space a little bit. But yeah, we're hoping that basically people who want to watch it enjoy it. If they enjoy it half as much as we enjoy making it, then I think that would be really pleasing.
I think you've pretty much sorted out every Arsenal fan's Christmas present for this particular year. Wake up and find a DVD shape in their stocking. People still use DVDs, don't they? Do they? A Betamax video version. I hope you're bringing it out on that. All right. Well, listen, good luck, of course, and I hope it goes amazingly well. I'm sure it will, because it is a fantastic story.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog.
Speaking of Christmas, can I ask you a little bit about what your thoughts are on the, funnily enough, Arsenal versus Liverpool game due to be scheduled on the 23rd, but more and more it appears like it's going to be played on the 24th of December. Should we have a couple of days off at Christmas? Is there a scope to give people a break to spend time with friends and family, or is this the way that football is going now? Have we just got to accept that when we have people like Sky and BT who paid so much money for the rights to football that they can pretty much do what they want?
Look, in my dream world, and I'm not talking about over Christmas and New Year, but I think that we should have a couple of weeks off, never mind a couple of days off. Mm. I think that the fact that we're still operating without a winter break in English football is bizarre. I often sort of put myself in the minds of or the experiences of the players, and we don't do this very often as individuals. Everybody just thinks they're paid so much, they must be able to withstand anything. And I read the interview that was in The Guardian with Chris Kirkland, the former goalkeeper, just a couple of hours ago, where he was very candid about his struggles with depression. And I do think culturally we've become kind of in quite a dangerous place where everybody feels that they can say whatever they think about this player or that manager or whoever it is involved in football, as if they're impervious to feeling these pressures because they earn so much money, which of course is a nonsense. And I just think that the kind of mental strain, forget about money because that's not the conversation, but the mental strain that we are putting these guys under, to be under complete scrutiny on a daily basis, to an extent, but certainly on a kind of weekly or twice a week basis when they're involved in games that are being broadcast, that are being analysed, that are being, you know, deconstructed by every second on a minute by minute on the internet or on Twitter or Facebook or whatever people are doing. I don't think it's that easy to live with. And when you think about how, even in just Arsenal's case, you know, the majority of players had a big tour to very, very far away places in the summer in pre-season. And that was busy, you know. Pre-season used to be going to Austria and hiding away in some little gorgeous spa town where there was, like, you know, three men and a dog and a sponsor dressed up as Ronald McDonald kicking off the game or whatever was going on. Yeah. And it was very relaxed. And it's pretty intense from the day they return after what kind of a holiday they get. And that's going to run right through to, you know, World Cup, if you're involved in the World Cup, which number of players will be, and then it starts again. And I think most of us in ordinary jobs, in ordinary lives, kind of need a week off here and there. Even if you don't go anywhere, just stop your job and stop your nonsense and switch off and do something else for a bit. I know I really value a break every now and again. Mm-hmm. I'm not shy to admit it. And I just feel that we're really loading the players and and to an extent managers quite dangerously. And even for fans, I mean, I think if you look around, you know, the grounds now, and it's not just the Emirates, I think you can see it at most grounds, increasingly large sort of dots of unused seats. There is more apathy because it's just so continuous. And, you know, going back to those old days of the 80s or 90s or whatever, can you remember how exciting it was when the season started again? Because you really didn't, you hadn't seen the players.
Yeah.
Hadn't seen them for 2 or 3 months. You hadn't heard a great deal about them because there was precious little coverage in papers in those days, apart from, you know, very kind of proper news if somebody moved or something happened. There was no gossip. There was no think pieces about how this team might do or that player might settle. It was just, people didn't really talk about football for a couple of months. And, you know, pre-season games weren't particularly for public consumption. So when the first game of the season came round, you absolutely couldn't. It was like a must-be-there thing to go to the first game of the season and see the team. But now you've probably watched 7 or 8 games on streams all through the summer.
Yeah.
So you kind of... I just worry slightly that we're creating an environment, and it's an unstoppable sort of juggernaut to the point where it wouldn't be that, you know, we're sitting here now talking about a Christmas Eve game, and I wouldn't be amazed if in a year or two you're saying, wow, should Arsenal really be playing their New Year's Day fixture in Jakarta?
Or should Arsenal not be playing on Christmas Day? I mean, I get what you're saying. We're in many ways we're creating the monster. We're feeding the monster because there is such a demand for football. But I think from a fan's point of view as well, you think about Liverpool fans who've got to spend the Christmas Eve traveling to London, watch the game, then back to Liverpool. Is there anything that fans can do to let people that run the game know that there is a line? I mean, can people be mobilized enough to say, look, enough is enough? There will be people, of course, for whom a Christmas Eve game is going to be great fun. There'll be people who don't have huge family commitments, who don't have to travel, who live locally. They go watch the Arsenal. They can go down the pub on Christmas Eve, and it's fantastic. But I think for the vast majority of fans, maybe I can't say the vast majority of fans, but for a lot of fans, certainly the ones that are feeding back to me on this story, you know, there are family issues. There are time zone issues. You know, there are issues with the day itself. The 24th is a day on which some countries celebrate Christmas. So it just feels like fans are not being considered, and we grow used to that. We all talk about, well, they don't care what fans think. But is there a way, or is it, have we gone beyond the point where what fans think actually matters, or what they do could actually change anything?
It's a good question, and I would love to think that fans can mobilise somehow and stop such things happening. I do feel, you know, particularly for the travelling Liverpool fans, I think it's really quite unjust to expect them to come down for a game, you know, that's an important game for them, you know. But, I mean, you almost think, and I hate this because people say, well, don't go, like, protest, you know, don't, you know, if nobody went. But that's a really...
That's a personal choice, and that's an
really
individual
horrible
choice.
Thing to put on someone who values their attendance at football matches as being a big part of their identity.
Of course, I think it's an individual.
Who's anyone else to say, don't go, make your protest. You don't have to go. Well, you know, if that's what you want to do, and you can afford to travel all over the, you know, long distances to support your team, and that's what makes one of the best parts of you find in your life if you were able to do it. Who's anybody else to say don't do it or make it so difficult for people? I would love to see, given how much money there is now that TV pours into it, they really ought to actually almost cover all transport for visiting fans for every game. Why not? If they want fans to be there as part of the spectacle, I mean, we're not saying free tickets because that, you know, they're not going to do that, are they? The clubs are not going to sanction that, but If there's an allocation of 3,000 Liverpool supporters for a game that they wish to put on on an inhospitable time or day, then they should be running trained or coaches or whatever it is. Mm. That are, which at least takes away one part of the potential problem. I mean, what, how that goes down with members of your family, I don't know, because that's difficult to...
Well, that is, yeah. I mean, it is. People have kids and wives and presents to wrap and places to be and people to see and all that kind of stuff. You know, I just feel like it's going to be... I think attendance will be negatively affected at the Emirates for sure. And I don't know that, given the way that attendances have been this season, that that's a positive development in any way. And fans as part of the spectacle are hugely important, as we know. And if you're doing something which is deliberately going to diminish or dwindle the attendance at a game, I think it takes away from the spectacle itself. People might stay home and watch on TV, but I don't know. I just feel like this one is maybe a line that they might regret crossing. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it'll be just the precursor to more football more of the time, because that seems to be what people want. But
can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Do you watch as much football as you did 5 years ago on telly, or more or less?
Less. Yeah. Much less.
I think that's... I'd be quite interested in a broader sort of pool of people to ask that question to, because... You know, it's weird. On one hand, it seems counterintuitive that they're putting more stuff on telly and paying more money for it. And yet, I think that there's, you know, people are finding it more difficult to watch so much of it just because it's a bit overwhelming.
Yeah, I even find like some weeks match of the day is like, meh. You know, and I feel bad for that at times, because it's my job is to write about football, to write about Arsenal. I mean, I'm not watching any less Arsenal than I ever did. But just what goes on around it, I find it more difficult to sit down and watch, you know, a Super Sunday where it's Burnley against West Ham. Whereas because in the past, the idea of live football was not a novelty, but... You know, I can remember I used to go to the pub every Sunday to watch the 4 o'clock game on Sky. This was before we had Sky Sports at home, before we were that fancy, and it was probably around the advent of the Premier League. And it didn't matter who was on, whether it was Arsenal or whether it was anyone else. You go down and just watch the game because it was a game of football live on TV, and it was kind of exciting. And I think you're right. There's a saturation point now where you're going, well, fuck, do I watch Premier League or Championship or Ligue 1 or Bundesliga or La Liga or, you know, all of the football that's available to you all of the time? It's just like, oh, fuck it.
I tell you, the Europa League's where it's at, mate.
And I've enjoyed the Europa League. And I had this conversation last week with Kieran from Swiss Ramble. And we both said, just by virtue of it being different, and by virtue of it not
there
being the same,
it's new. Yeah. Exciting in its own way.
Yeah.
But I just on the subject of, you know, how much football you watch and stuff, and the accessibility to it, guess what the viewing figures were for the Anfield 89 Liverpool Arsenal game?
I know this because I do.
Sorry, I see a not an international audience, which you can imagine that would have been massive in these days. It was just... I think it was probably just owned in England and maybe Scotland.
12 million, something like that, wasn't it?
You're not far off. I think it was 13 million.
Right.
That's a pretty large share of the population who would watch telly. And, you know, in those days, like, you know, sort of everybody watched telly because that was kind of, you had, what, three or four channels and that was it. So, you know, there was the chance that you were going to work or going to school or whatever it's the next day, and that most people have watched the same thing because you didn't have like 500 billion choices. But it was such a special thing. I mean, that was actually the first season of live televised football in English top division.
You know, we used to get live Division One football in Ireland on a Saturday at 3 o'clock.
Wow.
Which you guys didn't get because of the rules and regulations there, but we used to get live football on a Saturday. RTE used to show it, and you know, quite often it was Arsenal. But yeah, I mean, it's amazing that 12 or 13 million people who watched that Anfield 89 game, I just looked it up here, the average viewing figures for a Sky Super Sunday game is 1 million. Isn't that something?
Mm. Well, there you go. I remember in that season there was a... what became interesting is if you did well on a game on the telly, it meant something more. I remember Arsenal winning 4-1 at Nottingham Forest, and Forest were under Brian Clough, were, you know, fantastic side back then. And it was about October time, and Arsenal went up, and it was a really good game, actually. Forest went ahead, I think, and I think Arsenal missed a penalty. There was lots going on, and in the end, smashed them 4-1. And afterwards, not only did you just think, wow, that was great, and you're really happy and this and that, but it was like, you know, we've won a really big game on the telly. Like, everybody's seen it. And it felt sort of special and exciting in a way that we've lost that because of this saturation that you're talking about. It's impossible to replicate that sense of an event or an occasion.
Yeah. I wonder, is it because in some ways people are now able to watch what they want to watch? It becomes much more of an individual thing. So if you're an Arsenal fan, or you know, you can watch any Arsenal game you want. You don't have to be too tech savvy to find a HD stream on the internet, so you can sit and watch it on your laptop or your iPod or your phone.
You'll have to give me a lesson, Andrew.
Yeah, well, I don't want to. I'm not condoning any illegal activity here, Amy. So, but you know, I think that's true as well of other fans of other clubs. That if you're a United fan or a Tottenham fan or a Liverpool fan, that as well your focus is probably much more on your own team than the collective thing of Premier League football. Anyway, look, again, best of luck with the release of 89.
Thank you
for chatting to me about it, and we'll catch up with you soon.
Take care.
Thank you to Amy. You can find her on Twitter at AmyLawrence71. That is at AmyLawrence71. And if you haven't yet seen the trailer for 89, the film, just go to Google or your search engine of choice, whether it's Bing or Alta Vista or Ask Jeeves, Searchy McGee, whatever it is, just pop in 89, the film there, and it will return a result that you can then watch on your computerized device right until the very end. It's well worth it. 2 minutes of 92 minutes of a film that I'm very, very excited to see. I hope they've got some new footage of Steve McMahon. Steve McMahon and his 1 minute finger should have been a cartoon in Viz or an indie band or something. Anyway, maybe we should just enjoy it for what it is, a timeless, unforgettable sporting moment, an achievement against the odds. But, you know, if there is the chance to laugh at somebody else along the way, I'm on for that. I'm on for it. I'm sorry, Steve McMahon and your 1 minute finger. I'll never forget you. Just remember that, Steve, and your 1 minute finger. You live long in my brain. If one day I'm lying there on a bed and I can't remember shit, can't remember the name of my dog, don't know what day of the week it is, don't know my own name, I'm going to remember that fucking finger. You better believe it, Steve McMahon. Anyway, very quickly, before the end of the podcast, some team news. Lauren Koscielny, who's got an Achilles problem, he is going to have a fitness test. And if he comes through the fitness test, he'll play, because we've got no Mustafi, as we talked about a bit earlier, 4 to 6 weeks with a thigh injury for him. Kolasinac has got a bit of a hip problem, so he's going to be checked out. Mesut Ozil back in the squad. Danny Welbeck back in the squad. And, you know, we should be all okay for a game against Watford. Not going to be easy, because they're obviously playing very well. New manager Marco Silva, could he be the one? Could he be the next one? The one who everybody says should take over from Arsene Wenger, and within 18 months, his career is in the toilet, like so many that came before him. Maybe he could be the actual one. Who knows? He looks like a very good manager. He's got Watford playing some good stuff. It's not going to be an easy game, but hopefully it's one that we can take the 3 points from. And I think, do we have a Europa League action next week? We could do. Come on, Arsenal.com. Load faster. Results, yes, we do. Next Thursday, we've got Red Star Belgrade away from home. So we'll figure out our podcast schedule for next Friday. But James and I will be here on Monday. We'll have an Arscast Extra for you. We'll be looking back at the Watford game and everything else in between. Thank you, as ever, for listening, subscribing, for your comments and feedback. Really appreciate it. Hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you to Johnny Massacre for the music, the little intro and outro music to the Emmy Lawrence interview. Thank you, man. Appreciate it. Guy, oh, Jesus, my watch is telling me to move again. God damn it. Catch you on the next one, folks. Cheers. Bye-bye.
One-minute finger. One, not two. Ooh, I like that finger. Steve McMahon and his one-minute finger. Ooh, give me that finger. One, Steve McMahon and his one-minute finger.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.